This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next on Plains FM, the Shetland and Orkney Connection, brought to you by the Canterbury Shetland and Orkney Society.
Played by Shetland band Homebrew, signal 8:30 p.m. the last Monday each month
for the Shetland and Orkney Connection, produced by the Canterbury Shetland and Orkney Society and broadcast on Plains FM 96.9,
either directly in Canterbury or streaming live globally on broadband,
or available for 3 months after the broadcast via podcast on the website www.plainsfm.org.nz.
Some time ago, Barbara and I were joined in the studio by former colleague Cathy Hughes and by Frieda Lusa, a noted historian on the university staff at that time. She was widely known for the annual study trip she organised to Great Britain, one of which was specifically to Shetland and Orkney and the southern uplands of Scotland. Cathy and I were interested in the concept of regular tours, having travelled overseas several times ourselves. And of course, we all looked forward to Frieda's impressions of what Barbara and I like to call our islands, Shetland and Orkney.
Today's guest is Frieda Lusa, a senior history tutor at Canterbury University. She's a great enthusiast for lifelong learning, especially through UC community education courses, and she leads annual UC study tours to Britain.
The tour last June went to Shetland and Orkney, then to the southern uplands of Scotland. Nan and Cathy were interested in the idea of regular tours and, of course, in Frieda's impressions of our islands this time.
The study tours that I've taken overseas started in 2006. I have been teaching lectures within community education at the University of Canterbury since 1998. And there are a large number of people from Christchurch who come along to the evening lectures on either local history, but a large number on European history. And so in 2006, I was invited to take a group through to Britain, and we went from Edinburgh down to York doing the ancient Northumbria. And then the next year, we went to the Welsh borders. Then we've been to Devon and Cornwall, East Anglia. And then I decided this last year to go north of the border. And so that's where Scotland and Shetland, you know, came into the picture.
And, of course, that's where we first met you, a lecturer on Shetland, November last year. I love the way you describe yourself as a veritable Sassenach.
Well, I always have to apologise when I'm giving you a talk on Scotland, because unfortunately in my DNA I have not a strand of Scots DNA.
Well, Cathy would say the same. She's a Viking at heart, though.
Me too.
But, of course, I have Shetland parents, so you can imagine how excited others of us in the Canterbury, Shetland and Orkney Society were. So, Frieda, did it come up to your expectations, your trip to Shetland and Orkney?
Absolutely, much more so. I think it was the feeling that this was a wonderful opportunity for me personally to go to the Northern Isles. And so the study tour group met in Edinburgh, and then the next morning we flew up to Shetland, and I had an absolutely wonderful time in both Shetland and Orkney.
Was the weather kind to you?
It was glorious, and it was so surprising. It was actually raining in Edinburgh as we got on the small plane. And the sun was shining in Shetland, and that same day that we arrived, I literally was wearing a T-shirt, and that was a great surprise.
My mother remembered all her life, in particular the wildflowers of Shetland. Were they abloom when you were there?
Yes, they were. And that, too, was one of those lovely surprises. You rather expect a lot of wildflowers down in Cornwall or the south of England. But as we travelled through Scotland, literally from Shetland south, the flowers came into season and, of course, we're just that little bit further ahead, further south we came. But in Shetland, particularly the sea pinks, the thrifts on the coast and on those sea cliffs were just beautiful.
And could you tell us about the poppies, Frieda? They sound pretty amazing as well.
Well, that's right. That was more particularly in Orkney. And as we travelled along the fairly narrow roads, visiting places, these bright orange oriental poppies were just growing wild. Now, I know that the Department of Conservation doesn't like the lupins down in Mackenzie country, and these also in Orkney are probably introduced species that have gone wild. But the colour was magnificent, so I've got some beautiful photographs of those.
Oh, we maybe have the chance of seeing them sometime. You must have been disappointed not to be able to see the Moussa Broch, because I think, according to information maybe you gave us as well, that it's the most complete broch in Shetland.
That's right. These brochs, which are a dry stone fortifications, rather resembling at a distance a cooling tower, because they start wide, narrow in the centre, and then open out, many of them being dry stone and dating from literally around 100 BC, the Iron Age, have been destroyed over time from various reasons. But Moussa Broch is the best, as you say, and it was going to be one of the highlights of going to Shetland. But despite the sunshine, the wind was just too strong, sweeping down Moussa Sound, and the boatman with a fairly small ferry boat didn't feel it was safe to go across to the island. So we could just see it in the distance, but we couldn't get there.
The puffins, no doubt you saw the puffins, and the museum, which of course has gone up in Shetland since I was last there.
That's right.
And presumably you considered it of a very high quality?
Extremely. In fact, I think it's won an award, and it is not only attractively laid out, but so informative, and it really captures the whole spirit and perhaps resurgence of enthusiasm for Shetland itself, which, of course, you can see with the Shetland flag flying over the top. Very, very good. And, in fact, several museums through Scotland were very fine.
That's good to know. And, of course, get to Orkney, and it I'm sure you were as captivated as most of us are with St Magnus Cathedral and Kirkwall.
Yes, indeed. I think the various shades of the sandstone, the reds, the yellows, etc., are magnificent. The sheer size of it is also so surprising to see a Gothic, well, and in fact, even going back earlier, Norman Romanesque cathedral up there in the islands. And it has a special ambience. It really does.
It really does. And of course, I'm envious with the way you, how you left Orkney to go south from Stromness to Thurso, presumably across the Pentland Firth. Would that be right?
Yes, we took the ferry from Stromness. We had flown south from Shetland to Orkney, and then we decided that on the itinerary that we would take the boat. Now, it was a little bit of a gamble because the Pentland Firth is one of the most sort of ferocious and, in fact, in the past, one of the most dangerous passageways of, you know, the sea journeys. But it was beautiful, deep, deep blue, and we came past the famous Old Man of Hoy, the sandstone stack, and we got so many pictures of it. It was just wonderful.
Fantastic. Thank you.
That jaunty little tune, played by the Silkies, typifies the spirit of much of Orkney's folk music traditions.
Now it's Scotland's turn to work its magic, with Cathy and Nan curious about surprises, highlights, or even a lowlight or two.
Cathy and I have both had the thrill of spending time in Scotland, so I expect that some of your travels will cover places we have a certain familiarity with, but it seems as if you just never lost the landscape and the highlights that provided. What stays in your memory most of all, Frieda?
Well, there are so many. I think I could have pages and pages of highlights. But one of the most important things for me as an historian were the variety of castles that we saw on our journey. Literally from the north, from the Castle of May, the Queen Mother's famous home, down through Urquhart Castle on Loch Ness, and literally right down through Stirling, Edinburgh, and to the south. There's various stages of castles that in the construction in Scotland, and some of the earliest castles were brought into Britain at the time of the Normans, and they the construction of them develops at the time of King David in the early 12th century. And that some of the earliest ones are just simple Mott and Bailey, the rounded, almost Christmas pudding shape. And we visited one or two of those, simple, like Lumphanan, which is near the site where Macbeth was killed. And then you'll get a few of the old stone castles, which would be more familiar to people who visited within England, like Dunnottar on the coast. But there are also specifically Scottish-style castles that you just don't see anywhere else.
Could you tell us about those, please, Frieda? It's interesting to realise that there are the differences between the two styles. Well, there's probably more than two. The other thing that just going back to our previous talk about Shetland, was to, interesting thing was to find that our present queen is the first Queen of Scots. those were interesting facts that perhaps little known.
But that's right, yes. Well, I mean, Elizabeth I was Queen of England, but it was her successor, James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England. So, of course, Elizabeth I was never Queen of Scotland.
No.
And, Frieda, what marks out the Scottish baronial style from others?
I think one of the most important things is that with the castles that were built, if we consider in London, the Tower of London, the central keep, the White Tower, built by William the Conqueror, is that tall, square keep. And castles in Scotland took from that type of style the tower house, as you might call it. And the castle, for about 400 years, continued to be that shape, a square, tall keep. And sometimes it's three or four stories, sometimes even up to six. But very rarely developing a lot more out and round it in sort of other ramparts. So when you visit a Scottish castle, frequently you're going up spiral staircases, and all the living quarters and then the bedrooms and everything are one above the other in this very tall tower. And by the time you get into the 1600s, they're starting to get much more decoration near the top, some usually very small windows at the bottom, but the decoration at the top. And then the French influence comes in, and you get those tall witch's hat type towers that we associate with the Chateau of the Loire, for example.
Indeed. And of course, they would be built first and foremost for defensive purposes, wouldn't they?
Initially, indeed. And of course, they continued for a long time with that a defensive requirement. But as time progressed, they become a more comfortable home, But again, you would have storage at the bottom, and then you would have gradually going up through aspects of the living quarters, but with the most glorious views and probably the nicest rooms slightly higher up, and safer rooms as well.
Freda, could you tell us about the connection between the Declaration of 1320 and the Stone of Destiny, please?
Oh, right. Well, Arbroath is the connection between the two. When Robert the Bruce was declared king and was crowned at Scone in 1306, he wasn't accepted as king by all, and of course, over the next 10 years, there was the 1314 Battle of Bannockburn, of course, against the English. But in 1320, King Robert was still not accepted by the Pope and most of Christendom as the legitimate King of Scotland. And Scottish nobles got together at Arbroath and made that very, very famous declaration that, you know, while 100 of them were alive, they weren't going to submit to the English. And so the Declaration of Arbroath is one of the most important documents in Scottish history. It's a really patriotic, fervent...
And presumably the Stone of Destiny was in Arbroath Abbey.
Well, the Stone of Destiny was originally at Scone. And then it was captured by Edward I in the 1290s, 1296, and taken south to London, where he had the coronation throne specifically made with the place for the Stone of Scone, so that any English monarch from thereafter who was crowned sat on the Scottish Stone of Scone. It was stolen, probably the film Stone of Owner of Destiny that came out just a year or so ago captured the 1950 exploits of the Glasgow University students who went south at Christmas and stole the Stone of Scone. Well, no.
That's
they,
right.
Carried it back to Scotland. One can't call it stony.
Great film. It was so funny.
It was repatriating. But when they decided to give themselves up, they took the stone to Arbroath Abbey.
And Freda, with the castle, all the castles that you saw, all the towns, was there one in particular that you really remember, beyond the others even?
I think of the castles, they are so different that it would be very hard to actually say. I mean, Stirling is absolutely magnificent, or aspects of it, but... we had selected Craigievar Castle as our brand on the brochure and the posters. So anyone who had read in the university community education brochure, Learning for Life, would have seen Craigievar. And it is particularly splendid because it has been restored, and it was described in, I think, the Rough Guide to Scotland as a fantastic pink confection of turrets, gables, balustrades and cupolas bubbling over from its top three stories.
It sounds more like a fashion item than
well,
a castle.
Exactly. It's got the old harling, which was, or I should say harling, of the plasterwork on it, which has been repainted in more of the original deep pink semi-terracotta, and it is magnificent.
You've really got us fazed by the Monimusk reliquary.
Oh, yes.
Or the brick bannock in the Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh. What on earth is that?
Well, it was designed in the 8th century to hold a relic of St. Columba. Columba, of course, the Irish missionary coming to and founding the abbey at Iona. And it was preserved from Viking attack. It was taken inland. And this beautiful, it's only a tiny box. That was a surprise for me. I expected it to be much more like a sort of a shoebox size. But it's actually much, much smaller than that, only a few inches long. But it's covered in silver, and it's got its beautiful Celtic design and patterns on it. And it is a very, very sacred object, and it is one of the treasures of the Museum of Scotland.
Oh, my.
And it is why Robert the Bruce won at Bannockburn, because they had the Breck Bannock.
Now, I believe that you had a wee bit of a problem with heritage passes. I just wonder if this is worth passing on to perhaps people in the future, that they can learn something from this and make sure they've got everything in order?
Oh, well, it was only at the first place, and it wasn't our problem. It was actually the receptionist. Cottage Pass is a marvellous new invention that was brought out in April 2010, and it allows access to National Trust, Scottish Heritage, and a number of private heritage homes that have joined it. And it's very good. It lasts for a week, so we had several of them to cover the 3 weeks of the study tour. But they've replaced in Scotland, to a large extent, the Great British Heritage Pass, which we've used in previous years when we've been travelling through Britain. But those ones now are only available to individuals, not to groups over 10. Scotland has responded by bringing out this new pass. And it was only the first time we used it, I believe it was a national trust site in Scotland. It was so new that the person at the reception desk hadn't seen them. So okay. It was only that. But if anyone is going to Scotland, I would strongly suggest that they look at the Visit Scotland website and check out the Scottish Heritage Pass.
That's very helpful, Frieda. And we're getting to the time when we need to wrap up this delightful interchange of information and your impressions. But perhaps you could give us a brief word about the tour you're now planning for next year.
Yes, we've had five tours so far. And in 2011, during May, the University of Canterbury Community Education Abroad is planning a study tour to Normandy and Brittany. And the itinerary at the moment, it's still, the brochure is in being formulated at present, but any inquiries, any expressions of interest can be made to community education at the University of Canterbury. And that's, say, to Normandy and Brittany in May next year.
In other words, cider country.
Indeed. And in May, it will be very similar to our weather now.
Oh,
the blossoms, exactly. Yes, so blossoms, and of course, the relationship between Cornwall and Brittany is so incredibly strong, and with Wales, and Normandy, obviously, with England as well. So places like St. Michael's Mount, and of course, more recent history, we will be visiting one of the beaches where Commonwealth troops were involved in the Second World War.
Wonderful.
It sounds so interesting, and I'm sure there'll be listeners keen to follow that up. Frieda, thank you so much for your time. We have enjoyed it. We know there's lots more to share, but maybe there'll be another time. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Frieda.
Up with present time in October 2018, where the clock is showing that our time is nearly up. You probably heard things today that you already knew, but we can all enjoy prior knowledge being confirmed by experts. If there were facts and opinions that were new to you, the program is repeated at noon on Monday, the 12th of November. It may well enrich the plans and preparations that we'll all be making over the next few weeks. The visitors that will bring joy to our family life at home. The holidays, be they short or long, when we get to know other people and places. And make a note in your diary, the last social of the Canterbury, Shetland and Orkney Society for this year will be on Sunday, the 25th of November, in the Chapel Street Centre on Harewood Road from 4:30 p.m. to 6. Details will be in the November newsletter. In the meantime, keep well and keep smiling. Bye for now.